All right, well, let's get started. Friday afternoon session, folk music. We have three spectacular presentations for you. My name is Barry Stapleton. I'm the director of the Ward Irish Music Archives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'll be taking you through this session. Our first presentation is Curating a Crowdsourced Collection, Engaging Community at the Sacred Harp Museum. Jesse Carlsberg and Nathan Rees. And of course, I just lost. Jesse P. Carlsberg is a George W. Woodruff Fellow and doctoral candidate in American Studies at the Institute of Liberal Arts at Emory University. His research places the editions of The Sacred Harp, a shape note tune book, first published in Georgia in 1844, in their social and political context, and examines how ideas about race impacted interactions between Southern sacred harp singers and the folklorists and American music scholars who studied them. Jesse is the editor of the forthcoming Original Sacred Harp Centennial Edition, to be published as a digital scholarly edition and print facsimile edition. He is a managing editor of the Southern Spaces, a peer-reviewed, interdisciplinary, multimedia, open-access journal about regions, places, and cultures of the U.S. South. A sacred harp singer, teacher, composer, and organizer, he serves as vice president of the Sacred Harp Publishing Company, a nonprofit organization supporting sacred harp singing, and as editor of the organization's Sacred Harp Publishing Company newsletter. Presenting with him will be Nathan Key Rees. He's a visiting lecturer in American art history at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, with a PhD from the University of Maryland, College Park in 2010. His work on the visual culture of the sacred harp explores issues of identity and conceptions of authenticity relative to the genre's unique visual musical language. He has served on the board of directors of the Sacred Harp Publishing Company since 2009, and since 2011 has been curator of the Sacred Harp Museum in Carrollton, Georgia. Please welcome Nathan and Jesse.
It's great to be here. This is, I think, for both of us, our first time at this conference, and it's wonderful to meet so many of you and to experience what's really, we've all just been saying, a really friendly, warm, welcoming group of people, and also just a very interesting conference. So it's great to be here, and thanks for that introduction. So I'm going to start by just talking briefly about what sacred harp singing is, and then I'll introduce the organization, the Sacred Harp Publishing Company, that Barry just mentioned, and then talk briefly about the Sacred Harp Museum, and then I'll turn things over to Nathan, and we'll switch back and forth a couple of times. So sacred harp singing, as many of you may already know, is an a cappella group harmony singing practice that's active particularly in the United States South and states of Georgia, Alabama, Texas, Mississippi, but has also really spread nationally and internationally in the last 40 years or so, internationally really in the last just a few years. Sacred Harp singing is singing from a book that was first published in 1844 called The Sacred Harp. This is probably the most interesting looking cover of a Sacred Harp edition. That's the 1921 printing of the 1911 original Sacred Harp. In addition to being singing from this book and singing, of course, people also talk about it being a form of shape note music, where the note heads in the book have distinctive shapes, which is a means of making it easier to sing. Sacred Harp is also a musical culture that's formed around day-long annual singings held from the Sacred Harp, where participants in each of the four parts sit in a hollow square formation, facing each other, and take turns leading songs from the Sacred Harp. So we don't actually have a lot of audio to play for you today, but we did think it would be nice to play a song. So we'll listen to part of a recording from an early session of the National Sacred Harp Convention, which is a singing convention only founded in 1980 in Birmingham. But this is from the second session, and it's a song called Soar Away, which was written by Marcus Cagle, an Alabamian, in 1959. And it's about a minute and a half.
La, 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 la.
shape that's number. So the additions of the Sacred Harp initially were created through the actions of conventions such as this one. Singing conventions like the Southern Musical Convention, the Chattahoochee Convention, the United Convention, a convention still held in Atlanta originally and now across the South, authorized new additions and appointed singers to oversee the additions. Now, the Sacred Harp Publishing Company was established in 1933 to take that role over. In a way, it was inspired, I think, by gospel publishing companies. And so the initial purpose of the company was just to oversee future editions of the Sacred Harp. In 1973, the publishing company was reincorporated as a nonprofit organization and expanded its mission to think also about ways to promote Sacred Harp singing and to share and grow the audience that was singing Sacred Harp. The 70s was a time where, thanks to the intervention really of folklorists and other academics, Sacred Harp had come to the attention of an increasingly broad audience, and the publishing company decided to engage that audience. And they did that in a variety of ways. Starting in the late 1960s, they began issuing LP record albums. Most of these were recorded in studio by select groups of singers. The publishing company also published, you know, like little T-shirts and hats and things of that nature. But another major initiative starting in 85 was the National Sacred Harp Newsletter, which was a, you can see, probably the most appropriate Bible verse that you could find there. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps appeared on the masthead of every issue. So the newsletter ran from 85 to 93. It peaked at a circulation of about 1,000. It was sent to singers in this growing population around the world. Another major initiative started in the 1980s was the Sacred Harp Museum. And this is a picture of the museum. It's in Carrollton, Georgia. It was established in 1986 on land donated by a family of singers. And it was built, the whole facility was built by volunteer labor. So Nathan's going to talk a little bit about the museum's collection now.
Thank you. We actually have a somewhat unusual collection. Much of it involves material that you might expect. Archives from the publishing company, things that had sort of accumulated over the period during which this company was operating. But a large proportion of the material in the collection is actually what we refer to as crowdsourced. That is, it was donated by this same group of people who attend many of these singings. A lot of people made amateur recordings beginning in the 1950s and going up into the present. People found other types of materials that they thought would be of interest to other singers. Songbooks that had belonged to particular respected singers, their families frequently donated those to the museum, for instance. Correspondence and personal papers from people who are key figures in the history of Sacred Harp. News clippings are actually a big part of the museum's collection, and we have some multiple books, that were collected from, I think, the 70s up until the present by singers who were interested in compiling this material. And then also some other unusual types of printed ephemera. We have copies of scholarly books and essays, reference books, copies of papers, theses, and dissertations that different scholars decided to donate to the Sacred Heart Museum as well. So we have a really strange collection in that sense. So I've actually also got a photograph here of some of the books actually that belong to some of these singers. And we refer to this as crowdsourced. It's really kind of a different set of material than I've encountered at any other institution. And it poses a number of particular challenges. And I'm going to let Jesse address those.
Sure. Thanks, Nathan. So the one challenge that I want to focus on actually is the museum's physical location. So we're a small facility in Carrollton. The museum, and let's say and another challenge maybe would be staffing. But but our location is, in a certain way, it's an asset. West Georgia has actually been a center of Sacred Harp singing since the mid-1800s. There's several large annual singings that are held nearby. And so the museum does get some visitors. People come by the museum generally after a singing held in the area. So we might have the Georgia State Sacred Harp Convention just down the street fairly regularly. And I or Nathan or one of the other people associated with the museum will take people by the museum afterwards. and so people are able to visit the museum and enjoy things like these scrapbooks and look through songbooks and that sort of material. And the other sort of use that it does get is that scholars who study Sacred Harp and related traditions will often make arrangements to come by and spend some time looking at rare songbooks, looking at some of the publishing company's papers, and looking at other materials like that. But otherwise, the location of the museum basically off the beaten path limits its accessibility, right? And particularly, as even since the 80s, the population of singers has become more and more geographically dispersed. This, to us, kind of has become an increasingly problematic issue, something to think about. How can we make this collection more accessible to the new, broader range of singers, many of whom may not even be aware of its existence, even though they know of the publishing company as the place where they get their songbooks. so in thinking about what we could do to address this challenge, and I should just say for a second, the staffing problem is that we have an all-volunteer staff, right? There's no person who regularly works at the museum. There's no regular hours for that reason because there's no one there. So another challenge for access. So we've decided to work towards addressing this by focusing on, in a way, drawing on what Nathan says, focusing on the company's strengths and the museum's historical strengths. So thinking about how can we draw on the really integral connection that the museum has to the community that our collection comes from to try to improve access. And starting in 2011, the company established a committee on the future of the museum, of which I think we're two-thirds of, and since then, we've focused on increasing access to the collection, specifically through digitization and through new publication projects. So we think that this long-standing connection to the singing community, as well as this history of what we were calling crowdsourcing the collection building, is a way that we can leverage these strengths to address these challenges. So Nathan, we're going to talk, I think, now about three different initiatives that's come out of this, and Nathan will start by talking about our attempts to do take sort of a new approach to exhibitions.
Sure. So one of our goals is to make material more accessible, and that's really important to us because we have this body of people who have contributed this material in the first place. We feel like it's our mission to then provide it back to them in the best possible way. That's a way of both preserving this material, but also of making it much more accessible, as Jesse was mentioning. The first thing that we're interested in doing is creating online exhibitions. And I believe I can actually pull up. Okay, maybe not. Oh, sorry. Oh, excellent. Okay, I should have practiced the PowerPoint previously. My fault that Jesse put together. We decided to go ahead and start out by doing some online exhibitions. We thought of this as a way of making an exhibition that would be much more accessible for our audience, where we could take this material and then give it back to them in a form that's maybe even more useful for them, because not only do we make it more accessible, but we provide a kind of discursive framework by which they can actually understand it a little bit better as well. We're coming up in June on the 35th anniversary of the first National Sacred Harp Singing Convention, which was organized by some of the early, well, for our perspective, some people who are now old, I guess I should say, in the 1980s as a way of... sorry. As a way of bringing together all of these new geographically dispersed communities who are interested in singing sacred harp. Hugh McGraw, who was at that time the leader of our organization, created this national convention. It was a sort of big moment of celebration, and it was also very different than most other sacred harp singing conventions. It was 4 days, for one thing, so it extended over a large amount of time. It featured not only the singing, which is generally 98% of a sacred harp convention, but also things like little speeches, recognition of important people. One of the things that Hugh McGraw was really interested in particular, was emulating 19th century traditions as a way of kind of promoting the idea of this being something with a weighty and important past that shouldn't be forgotten, even though it was getting a new national audience from a lot of folk revival people, for instance. So he did things like invited leaders to stand up and lead songs for about 20 minutes at a time instead of just individual songs. These are all kind of details that, you know, if you're maybe more familiar with sacred harp culture, if we could get into it in a little bit more detail, you would understand how different this was, what a momentous occasion this was in 1980 when they organized it. So we looked at all the material that we have in the museum and tried to find a way to create an online exhibition that would make good use of this, that would also sort of help interpret it, something that would be interesting to people who had attended, also to people who really didn't recognize this as the important moment maybe that it was. So I actually will just give you a very brief tour and invite you to check this out if you would like. OriginalSacredHarp.com is our web address, and we can give you some more details if you're interested in this. We have an extensive kind of historical sketch about the history of this convention, drawing on some of the archival material that we have in the museum, including correspondence with Dan Patterson, who's actually here at UNC Chapel Hill that some of you may know. Asked him about how to make a new convention that would be like an old one, basically. We've also got an album of photographs from the convention. And this is part of our bringing the crowdsourced material back to the crowd. And we could maybe scroll through these, but I won't take the time to do that now, other than to tell you that most of these photographs were actually just done by amateur people who attended this event and then gave those to the museum. We've also got audio files. They recorded the whole convention and put it out on a set of 8 cassette tapes. Those total, and it probably will take a while to even load our stuff here, but we have 344 tracks that you can now go through and listen to from this convention in this little playlist format. And then we've also got a few other odds and ends if you go through. There was a booklet that was produced that we now have in PDF format for download. And then I did want to show you this special hat, actually, that they made for the convention in 1980. And my light box isn't working there for some reason, so I have to few little bugs in this. Like I said, it's actually in June when the anniversary of the event is taking place that we're going to actually sort of launch and kick off this website. But we felt that this was a great way to take this material, give it back to our audience, maybe in an improved format that is more useful for them and is certainly more accessible than just living at the museum in Georgia.
And I think we're also really hoping that putting this out there will be a way to then further strengthen the museum's holdings in this area. So I think one thing that we're hoping is that there's a lot of people who, at the very least, have memories of this first event or the early national conventions, but may also have additional material from the event, whether it's photographs or ephemera, we'll see. So we are encouraging people to get in touch with us about that, but then the convention itself, where we'll make a kind of an official launch of the exhibit, will be a place where we can do that. So I'm going to talk briefly about two other initiatives. The one is a publication project, basically a new iteration of the Sacred Heart Publishing Company's newsletter from the 80s, and then the other one is a new oral history project. So briefly, the Sacred Heart Publishing Company newsletter, we're not calling it the National Sacred Heart Newsletter anymore because we don't want to be presumptuous, and we also don't want to seem not to acknowledge all of these international Sacred Harp singings that have sprung up. But we launched this newsletter, I guess, 2 years ago now. We're in volume 3. And we're featuring new articles written by singers from across the U.S. and Europe, sharing news about their own singings, things happening in their communities, as well as reporting on their own research in Sacred Harp. A lot of singers are interested in the history of this music, and this is a way to actually build. We've published articles presenting real new findings about important figures in Sacred Harp's history, written by independent scholars who are Sacred Harp singers. but it's also been a way to promote and disseminate research by these amateur scholars as well as by academics. There's a lot of academics who happen to sing Sacred Harp and from time to time will do a project, and they've been able to use the newsletter as a way to share that with a general audience interested in Sacred Harp. It's also, though, a way to share materials published in the old run of the newsletter. The publishing company museum, of course, has a complete run of the old newsletter, and other documents in the museum's collection, such as photographs, correspondence, interesting kind of other documents, including both materials that are part of the publishing company's sort of official papers, but also material donated by singers, have been things that we've been able to draw on and contextualize in the newsletter. So I want to talk briefly just about one of those articles to give a sense of how this might work. So this is an essay by a singer named Raymond C. Hamrick, who's still living. His 99th birthday party, which will be an all-day singing, is on June 14th. So you all should come to Roberta, Georgia on June 14th and sing with Raymond Hamrick. He's a singer. He was a book collector. He's now donated all of his books to Emory University, actually. Also, just really curious about Sacred Harp singing. And one of the fascinating things about Sacred Harp is this practice of keying, where rather than using a tuning fork or something like this to set the pitch for each song, you may have heard at the beginning of the audio sample we played, an accomplished singer will provide a key just from memory or from something. And Raymond was the person who did this for South Georgia for many decades, and he got to wondering, how do we do this? Are we consistent? Like, are we good at it? What is the pitch's relation to the written key? Is there variation among the keys that different pitchers get? How do people arrive at their keys? And are there even differences in different places? So he conducted a study. He wrote to all of the keyers in Georgia. They wrote back to him, describing how they arrive at their keys. He then tested for each letter key, each written key, the relationship between the key as played on the piano to the key that was produced in the recording that he made, and put together a table that indicates basically that the key tends to be either somewhat lower or at the written pitch. So he found that and published an article in the newsletter, in the national newsletter in the 80s. So we took this document, we digitized it, transcribed it, and then invited a scholar, a guy named Ian Quinn, who's a professor of music at Yale, who happens to be studying Sacred Harp keying now, to write an introduction. So you can see here, there's a great chart. This is Raymond's findings from 1986 with Ian's study from 2011, 2010, relatively similar findings. The difference, you can see there's some music that's pitched a little bit higher, though still lower than the written pitch in Ian's study, and he has some ideas about that, so you can go read about that if you'd like. But what I think is neat about this article and a number of the other pieces we published in the newsletter is that, first of all, we're taking a really fascinating piece of research that's not widely known, that was published in our newsletter, but isn't even, I think, something that most contemporary singers were aware of, and presenting it again, but then also contextualizing the findings. We're also giving Ian an opportunity to share his research with interested singers. And so in a way like this is one of how a number of pieces that we publish can bring together the different kind of segments of people in the Sacred Harp world and bring stuff like this to light to new folks. So I'll just briefly talk about our oral history project. There we are. That's me. Which is? Are we out of time? Oh, we got 5 minutes. Okay. Well, I'll take 2 minutes. How's that? Anyway, this is another project that the museum's just started. That's really about collection building as well as these aspects of drawing on our collection strength. And it's our first new initiative that's specifically oriented towards collection building. So, and this actually started off, John Bondurant's here. I've been working with Berea College at doing some oral history interviews for the Berea College Sound Archives. And we've been talking to singers around Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, asking a bunch of questions kind of about their own history of participation in Sacred Harp, how Sacred Harp singing has changed in their lives. We've also been having singers bring out their personal and family collections of tune books and ephemera, not fully digitizing it, but documenting things like wear to assess how different editions of the book have been used across time and space and things of that nature. This has kind of got us thinking about, wow, really a dozen interviews only scratches the surface, and there are so many singers who can shed light on this musical culture as well as on how it fit into larger issues of the politics and society in the area at the time. And we'd like to talk to more people. So we're at the beginning of talking with Berea about forming some kind of partnership, basically, to expand on this work and find a way for it to have a nice archival home at the college. But also have the museum be a way to provide access to the material. Because in addition to being interesting to a small number of scholars, it's interesting to a large number of singers, what these people have to share. So another thing that's been interesting about doing these interviews is that it's gotten singers to come forth again with material in their personal collections. A couple of our singers who we've talked to happen to have made recordings with even older singers. There's a singer named Lucy Heidorn, who in 1973 interviewed a range of singers, some of whom were able to recall singings in the 1890s. And she's kept these interviews in her home, but they're not in an archive, they're not being securely preserved and things like that. So we also hope that the Oral History Project will be a way to provide an archival home for material like that. So basically to conclude, all of this work we hope it helps improve the preservation of material that otherwise might be lost as singers die, in providing a pathway to the museum and then potentially through the museum to other institutions where material can be properly preserved. We can help singers who haven't made plans to deal with such materials. And through digitization, publication, and interpretation, we also hope we're making this material more accessible than if it sat in singers' homes or even just in the museum, and hopefully we think this could encourage additional new activities such as this oral history work and future collection building. So thanks for your attention.
Thanks, Jesse and Nathan. Fantastic. Any questions for them? We have about 5 minutes for questions.
Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, what we're doing right now actually is really gathering information and formulating an approach. So we have a couple of university archives that are interested in partnering with us, and we need to fully inventory our material and describe it before we can really figure that out, and we'd also like to find a way to work with all of the interested institutions. What I think is the likely eventual way to deal with this work is for the sensitive materials and rare materials to be housed in an appropriate university archive. But again, to think about the museum, both the website and the physical location as an important access point, for a fairly large audience that isn't as likely to come to a university archive.
Just go ahead, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
the museum is a cool place. So right now you can listen to any of our VHS cassettes on a nice little television. But no, but I mean that's a great idea. We're installing a scanner and a computer at the museum right now so that we can do at least some preliminary digitization work, but also have the computer as an access point to audio and to digitize materials so that people don't have to work with the original at the moment. But I think that's a great idea, a listening station. And also I think our website is a place where we can do things like that. Yeah. Yeah, and so born digital collections is another area where I think we need to be paying more attention. And there's dozens of singers who are making amateur recordings at the moment, and there's actually fairly good coverage even of all of the annual singings held. Yeah. Yeah. And Todd Harvey's back there, and the Library of Congress has that 1942 recording and is taking great care of it. But yeah, I mean, that's what Nathan raised, right, is that there's dozens, hundreds, thousands of recordings of singings from the 50s through the 80s, and it would be great to, we are interested in collecting that material and digitizing it. And you know, my wife actually has worked with an iPhone app developer. We have an app where you can browse the minutes and where recordings are extant, you can listen to the actual song. So these records of singings held, you can really get access on your phone.
Hey, one more question. Yes, ma'am.
In the meantime, could you put links on your website for other folks who have Sacred Heart materials on their website?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great idea. There's a website. If people could go to bostonsing.org at the moment is, I think, the website that has the largest collection of personal singers' recordings of singings from the 70s, but mostly contemporary. But yeah, that's a great idea to put some of those resources on our site.
Thank you so much, Jesse and Nathan. Great project.
Thank you.